This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. If ever there was a clear-cut example of a community whose residents deserve reparations, it would be Tulsa, Oklahoma's Greenwood District, known historically as Black Wall Street, and destroyed by a white mob more than 100 years ago. Descendants of the survivors of the so-called Tulsa Race Massacre have been agitating for reparations for years. In the meantime, a new generation of Tulsa's residents are rebuilding what was lost. Writing about it for Yes Magazine's new Realizing Reparations series is Annalisa Bruner, writer and editor. Her great-grandmother was Mary E. Parrish, a survivor of the Tulsa Massacre. Welcome to the program, Annalisa.
Thank you, Sonali.
So let's first start by talking about how we have this very clear-cut case in Tulsa, Oklahoma, specifically with the Greenwood District, where history and all the historical documentation shows systematic harm done on the basis of race. If there was ever a clear-cut example of the need for reparations or a case where reparations were owed, one could say it would be Tulsa's Greenwood District. Would you agree? And if so, why haven't we seen them yet?
I would absolutely agree with that assessment. Particularly because it is such a discrete moment in time, it does not linger. It's something that happened from one distinct moment of beginning and one distinct moment of ending. Of course, the repercussions are unending, but in terms of looking at it, it's very easy to see that it is a clear-cut case where on the basis of race, people were attacked, killed, their properties were seized, and they were disenfranchised in the most organized and heinous way. And when I say the most heinous way, at the hands of the local government, their involvement is very clear. And so I do think that the reason it has not happened is that there is a precedent that would be set. And I think that that precedent is an uncomfortable fact in terms of people demanding more and having a broader scope of the demand for reparations. I think that they feel it would be a domino effect. And once this got into play, there would be, I think, in their minds, no end.
So tell me about how people who continue to live in Tulsa, particularly those who can trace their ancestry back to the survivors of that awful massacre, survivors like your descendants like yourself, how they, especially younger generations, are thinking about the legacy that their forefathers and mothers left them and building on it. Is there this awareness among descendants of what they carry?
I think there absolutely is. I think that you can see it in conversation with people. You can see it with the work that's being done in the community, the organizing, and with the reemergence of this as a prominent historical fact and legacy. It gives people an opportunity to really tap into public awareness in terms of generating support in a more broad-based way than there has been in the past. And I think that absolutely people think that this is a great moment to seize upon their demands for reparations, their demands for investment in the community. And I mean meaningful investment. I don't mean, superficial things where people can be made to feel good about what they're doing, but without meaningful sacrifice. And anything meaningful, in my opinion, does take some measure of sacrifice and intentionality. And I think that we have not seen that yet.
So let's talk about the story that you wrote for Yes Magazine as part of our series, Realizing Reparations. In it, you point out how there is this network of connections that continues to exist today. And those people who are very aware of that network, who are honoring their legacy, are trying to build new connections. I mean, obviously, one can never recreate everything that was lost, and especially without government acknowledging and help and compensation, it becomes really, really difficult. So give me a sense of that network that continues to exist in Tulsa today, in spite of everything that was destroyed, the lives that were erased, the institutions that were erased. Those networks are strong.
I think the networks have been destroyed and recreated, destroyed and recreated. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a very important point to emphasize and to remember. There was a time, and this was at the time of the massacre and preceding, when segregation was the law of the land. And, African-Americans and other communities certainly had to rely on one another. There was no outside community for church, for civic life, for commerce. These kinds of things were strong within a community because people knew one another. They had each other's backs. And ultimately, there was no other choice. Not to say that people would have decided to do something different, but certainly in practice and in law, people were interacting with one another in all aspects of life. That network that you mentioned was very much disrupted in 1921. Some people left. Some people had to flee. Some people remained. And those, are different profiles of people and their responses to a traumatic, heinous event like this. But the community did rebuild. Some of those networks were established anew. Some were resurrected, I'm sure. But over time, everything has its own iteration. Things don't necessarily come back the way they were, for good or for ill. The community did rebuild successfully, but times changed. And there were other aspects of quote-unquote progress that really kind of finished off, I think, what the massacre started, namely the interstate that dissects the community right through the heart of Greenwood, as though it is cutting off an artery of life. To this day, that event, or that time period that ended with the opening of the expressway, really has put a pall over the community. I mean, it has done something that the massacre did not do. It really, really, really disrupted those communities, those senses, the sense of network and community. More people left, businesses shuttered. And so we know that those kinds of events are the death knell for our community. Nevertheless, the memory of Greenwood, the reverence for Black Wall Street and all that it was, continues there. And I think there is a flame that simply needs to be fed, that can do as one of the artists who I interviewed for the piece, can bring Greenwood to a 3.0, if you will. So there have been iterations, and there is, I think, a spirit afoot of a second renewal, if you will.
Let's talk about some of the people who you profile in your story for Yes. I think you might have been referring to the artist Galani right now, yeah. Who can trace their ancestry back to Greenwood. Tell me about Galani and how they have really tried to reinterpret maybe their grandparents, great-grandparents' legacies, and make beautiful art in a way that helps to explain what happened or make sense of that terrible massacre.
I mean, what Galani has done is absolutely amazing. It's beautiful. It's poignant. It's melancholy. It is full of meaning. Galani descends from the Williams family, which was one of the preeminent families of Black Wall Street. Their great grandmother, Lula Williams, owned the Dreamland Theater there, owned a confectionery. I believe they owned, had business interests in hotels and different kinds of things. Really, really, really. And, the family was a pillar of the community. All they had was taken away during that horrible time. And Galani's great grandfather was 16 years old at the time of the massacre and helped physically to defend the community. And when the great grandfather grew older, when he was time for him to go away to college, his mother, Lula, wrote him some very heart-wrenching letters about her hopes that had been dashed, her dreams that had been stolen, and a future that she could not really see clearly, how she was going to navigate it. Those letters were preserved, and Galani has taken those letters and used AI to recreate the voice of their great grandfather to read those letters that were written to the great grandfather when he was a young man in college, and to hear the older voice reading the letters that were written to him as a younger man from someone who was long gone when that voice of the mature gentleman was here with us on earth is absolutely breathtaking. I mean, it is a very surreal experience to listen to the way that they are those layers of time that converge in Galani's imagination and what they have done and the product that they have created, the piece of art that they have created from all those disparate pieces across eras.
Annalisa, you also spoke for your story with Victor Luckerson, who wrote the book Built from the Fire, the epic story of Tulsa's Greenwood District, America's Black Wall Street. What has Victor found, and what did Victor share with you about the way in which Tulsa is writing its new chapter?
Victor Lukerson is a wonder. Victor transplanted to Tulsa about 5 years ago because, as he says in an interview that the interview that I did with him, he was seeking a way to look at this event as part of a continuum, not the only story of Greenwood, not the only story of Black Wall Street, which is how it's predominantly known. And so Victor embarked on a 5-year mission to collect a whole history of that district. And he has produced a wonderful work of scholarship, journalism, and art that is really, really an epic tale. The time period that he covers, the events that unfold, the historical importance of what Oklahoma represents for, indigenous community, the indigenous community of this country, African Americans, and people basically looking for a place where they could have full expression of their dreams, of their aspirations, and of their desire for safety and security. That is what they thought they found in Greenwood. Victor has taken all of these pieces over time through a very thorough program of research and put it together in a really a magnificent work that is now being used in various history departments at universities across the country. So what he's done has been wonderful. He has captured so much the essence of what Greenwood was and what it became and what it is becoming. One of the most important things that I felt Victor said during the interview I had with him was that young people are looking at his book and taking from it, things that with which they can identify. They have a sense of connection with it, even though they may have grown up not knowing the details, not knowing all of the history, but they are being drawn in a way that I think will give a foundation for people to understand what was lost, what people were actually doing and accomplishing, and what may lie ahead. What are the takeaways? What are the, you know, the aspirations? And what are the tools that people have, the tools of community, right, and organizing and networking to bring this community forward?
What happened in 1921 has, especially on its 100th anniversary in 2021, became more known in the mainstream. Newspapers started to cover it. And there was a whole TV show that was premised on what happened in Tulsa, and that's HBO's Watchmen. You point out in your story for Yes that the way in which the documentation is being done about what happened in Tulsa really matters, and that maybe Watchmen didn't necessarily center the experiences and the voices of survivors, but a film by Nyla Jefferson did. She's another person that you spoke to. Tell me about this documentary and how, in your words, this film gave people the opportunity to tell their own stories in their own voices.
Descended from the Promised Land by Nyla Jefferson captures the essence of what the feeling is for many descendants who live there in Tulsa, who feel that many of the stories that have come out that have garnered attention for the community have been good in a way, but they have lacked something truly important and central, which is the voices of the individuals whose families actually lived this experience and know what it was like, know in their heart what was lost, not just intellectually. And so I think that what Nyla does, and she is a complete community outsider, although she did have some connections within the community, that did give her some credibility there. What she has done is given voice to those families, but also set a precedent, made it okay for them to talk about it, and made it, I think, for people who are audience members or viewers or whatever the case might be, understand that those voices are central. It's not enough to just talk about it as an outsider, to frame it, even if you have good intentions. It is important for us to hear from the Galanis and from others who are descendants and who have lived with the weight, the burden, and the pride of Black Wall Street. And I think that is particularly significant about the work that Nyla Jefferson has done.
One of the my favorite lines in your story, Annalisa, is this one that I just want to read for our audience. A third act for the storied community will need to rely on the resiliency exemplified by brave residents who stayed and rebuilt, all while masterminding a future that will be able to meet the new environment. Let's wrap up our conversation by talking about this resiliency. I mean, it's kind of difficult to think about, you know, living in a country that has never truly acknowledged the harm that was done by the state, that requires resilience, right? And it shouldn't be required, but yet it's there. And I'm wondering if you can just expand on this, and then also tell us your own story, your links to the Tulsa massacre and who your great-grandmother was.
I think you have touched on a very important point, Sonali. Mm. It is a shame that people have to exhibit grit, resiliency, forgiveness, and things of this nature. These are all seen as positive attributes, but in some ways, the fact that people are required to participate in those characteristics mean that some great harm is being done to them. And that is truly an unfortunate circumstance, particularly when there has been no recompense, no recognition, and widespread recognition at the decision-making levels. And people are left to figure it out for themselves. And I think that is a heavy burden, and it's something that should not people should not have to live through. Nevertheless, the resiliency is what has enabled this community to come back time and again after disruption. People talk about that word. That word very much a catchword. And some people see it as a positive, but it depends on what the circumstance it is. The circumstances. In this case, disruption has been a horrible thing. It has been a horrible event, and it has made the community. It has broken it apart. In some ways, it brought it together. But that is not, I think, the only way that communities can be brought together. And so it is, I think, truly a tragedy that that has been the pathway to the community networking that's going on now, as people seek reparations, as people seek a rebuilding of that sense of community spirit and relying on one another for their needs and for advancement. I do think that it is something that people sometimes use as a way to. They say, "Oh, this good thing came out of it, and so what happened wasn't so bad." And I really take exception to that. I think it's a cop out, and I think that it's a way that people who have done harm, in some ways, kind of lessen the importance of what that harm has manifested. And so, in that way, I actually resent that word in some ways. But nevertheless, when people do, as a characteristic, employ resiliency to rebuild and to move on with their lives, it's a good from their spirit, from their abilities. But it is not something for somebody else to say. It's a good thing that
Right.
face and be resilient.
Tell me about your great grandmother, Annalisa, finally, and how that ancestry informs your work.
It's very interesting because although I have a deep ancestry in Tulsa, in Oklahoma in general, I am an outsider. And before 2021, I had never stepped foot in Oklahoma. My father was very close-mouthed about this. His mother, my grandmother, who was a 7-year-old survivor of the massacre, and who went to California, San Francisco, where I was born, she was close-mouthed about it. I had no idea that any of this had ever taken place until I was in my third into in my mid-30s, when my father gave me a book. He pulled it from his private papers and he said, "Well, I'm giving this to you. I want you to see if you can do something with it. It's a book that your great-grandmother wrote." And I do have that original copy here. It is one of the books that was printed originally in about 1923, about 20. Five copies or so, we believe, were privately printed. The title at that time was Events of the Tulsa Disaster by Mrs. Mary E. Jones Parrish, my great grandmother. And so when I
Can
saw this
you hold
book,
it up for our TV audiences?
absolutely.
Wow.
It
Incredible.
is one of my cherished possessions, as you can well imagine. And so over the years, I have studied, I have tried to figure out what I could do that would bring this story to public attention. But once Watchmen came out, and once Trinity University Press was in the process of reissuing the book under the title The Nation Must Awake, I was invited to participate. I wrote the afterword. The foreword was written by the posthumous. It was a posthumous essay from Dr. John Hope Franklin, who was also a Tul who grew up in Tulsa. His father, Buck Franklin, survived the massacre and was one of the lawyers who brought the cases against the insurance companies and against the city for recompense for compensation. But for me, I didn't find out about this until I said again, as I said, I was in my mid-30s. I am now in my mid-60s, and the occasion of the 100-year anniversary in 2021 was an opportunity for me to bring my great-grandmother's name back to the public forefront. And that is my charge. It's what I think my father would have wanted. He told me to see what I could do with it. What I'm doing with it is, I think, resurrecting the legacy of Mary Jones Parrish and the centrality of the work that she did, recording voices from people who had survived and stayed in Tulsa. She also did an accounting of some of the losses. And she measured, I mean, there are actual metrics in the book about what individual property holders lost, you know, what the involvement of the local government, the local police, the National Guard, what the Red Cross did to help, all kinds of things. And there were depictions in the book about the planes that flew overhead and dropped turpentine bombs and dynamite on buildings and on the residents. It was something that had never been seen in the United States before. It was the first pogrom in the United States that used firepower from the air to destroy the community. So this was really probably one of the most widely known of the pogroms against African Americans, but certainly not the only one. I think that the work that she did deserves to be recognized, as does she.
Well, I want to thank you so much for sharing that history with us, Annalisa. It's been an honor working with you, and I really thank you for the beautiful piece that you did for Yes Magazine as well. Much luck to you, and hopefully someday in our lifetimes we'll see reparations for the Tulsa for the survivors and descendants. Thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me on your program, Sonali. I appreciate this opportunity to share my thoughts and to also share the life of my great-grandmother.
I've been speaking with Annalisa Bruner, a writer and editor and descendant of the Tulsa Massacre survivors. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify.